Everything's coming up roses on Garden Talk today. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks so much for joining us on the Ideas Network. Our guest today is David Slezak. He is a professor of horticulture at the University of Wisconsin River Falls, and he's a certified professional horticulturist and consulting rosarian. So, talk about roses that thrive in cold climates, rose diseases, and take your other gardening questions. David Slezak joins us by phone. Hi, David. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hi, Larry. It's great to be with you and all the wonderful gardeners across the state of Wisconsin.
How'd you get so interested in roses?
Oh, that's a great question. When I was a kid growing up in the Milwaukee area, I loved gardening because that helped me feel connected with my grandparents that lived on the other side of the state. My parents left the country to go to the big city, and so I just loved exploring nature with my grandparents. And so I got a little bit of everything that I thought was important to gardeners as I listened to wonderful gardening programs like the Victory Garden on PBS and read the local newspaper. And so I knew I needed a rose bush. So I got a rose bush. And then a little bit later, when I was about 13 years old, there was an article in the Milwaukee Journal about Bill Rattler's rose breeding hobby and the idea of breeding plants, coming up with what we don't have yet, imagining the what ifs, and working towards that inspired me. So I reached out to him, and he was a great mentor, and I've been breeding roses ever since.
Yeah, and you have some wonderful roses. I tell you what, it's a Rosa Above and Beyond is a beautiful rose.
I'm so grateful for it. I love it. I thought it would take multiple generations to bring together the characteristics I was hoping for. Disease resistance, hardiness, warm colors, repeat bloom. And it's pretty close to wild species. Its dad is a hybrid of a wild rose from eastern Canada and a wild rose from Siberia. So that brings in the extreme hardiness and then the warm color from the tender yellow miniature that was the mother. And so this amazing, large-growing, hardy, climbing or freestanding shrub came about from just a couple generations of those crosses.
They're really beautiful. Why are climbing roses seem to be difficult to grow in the northern climates?
Yeah, because what we value about them is that extra size. So they could go up those trellises, be tied to a pillar, and if they die back, we lose that height. So we really need strong cane hardiness in order for them to fulfill that purpose. And very few roses are hardy enough for our Wisconsin climate to survive without insulation.
Yeah. So that's the problem, the hardiness, and the hardiness zones. You need to pay a little bit of attention, don't you, to those zones if you're going to be growing roses?
Yes, yep, as well as the other perennial plants that we love to grow, trees, shrubs, herbaceous perennials. So those USDA cold hardiness zones are determined based on the minimum winter temperature. How cold does it get? And so, for instance, much of Wisconsin is in zone 4, which means that it typically gets between negative 20 and 30 degrees below zero Fahrenheit. Zone 5, the 10 degree range is a little bit warmer. Zone 3, you know, negative 30, negative 40. Those estimates are a little arbitrary as we put that together with the idea of hardiness. So not only does cold temperature impact how well plants survive, but also what time during the fall, winter, and early spring the coldest temperatures are experienced, as well as moisture. So it's a good guideline in general. And so as we look at those zone ratings, you know, make sure as we're looking in catalogs or on tags that whichever zone that we happen to be in across Wisconsin, we have zones 3, 4, and 5, know what zone we're at. Make sure that the plant has that number or a lower number, which means that it could tolerate even colder. These zone ratings are a little arbitrary. So some nurseries might say, well, the plant at least lived. So, okay, it's hardy here. but for climbing roses, we need more than that. We need it to stay up our trellis, have significant amount of live wood. So it's a starting point. Look at those zones and then talk with our gardening friends. Go to local arboretums, parks, plantings where we could see some of these roses as well as other plants in our area.
We have some folks online who have questions for you, and let's take a call or two here just to get going. Let's go to Tom in Green Bay now. Tom, thank you for calling.
Hi, I've got a climbing rose, but every June, not this year, but because it's so wet and it doesn't seem to be pushed forward, I get top flies, and then the June beetles come in and eat all my roses. I was wondering if there's anything I can use that won't hurt the bees and stuff, too. That's the other thing.
You said June beetles. Did you mean Japanese beetles? Or were they?
Correct, Japanese beetles.
Sawflies and Japanese beetles are after Tom's roses.
Yeah, they're after mine too, Tom. those sawflies, they have these little larvae. So the adults lay these eggs, and then we get these little green caterpillars. And they, for viewers, listeners that may not know, what they do is they scrape off the undersides of the leaves. They usually live on the underside of the leaf. And then where they scrape, that portion of the leaf turns brown and dries up. So for these sawflies, there's actually three different species of sawflies. Unfortunately, the most common ones just have one cycle per year. And as Tom mentioned, in June, I already have some here in May earlier too, but they just go through one cycle, and after we're through that, we're good for the season. There's a third species that keeps having cycles, the bristly rose sawfly, through the season. So if we can get through especially that early part without too much damage, we should be good. So what we can do is use some lower impact insecticides, insecticidal soap. If you have good eyes, they're kind of small, you could lift up the leaves if you don't have too many roses and just squish them. Use insecticidal soap to smother them, and that doesn't hurt the bees because we're not spraying it directly on the bees. So that's good for the sawflies. We could also use standard insecticides if you feel comfortable with that too. But of course, we want to protect the bees. The Japanese beetles, they come in force typically the end of June and through much of the rest of the summer. They eventually kind of, become less abundant towards fall. But so they're very hungry. They eat many different species. Roses are just one. So what I do is I try to pick as many as possible and just put in soapy water. But we could only do so much of that. There's some newer chemistries. I don't necessarily want to, promote a whole bunch of pesticides, but entomologists that I know at University of Minnesota does a lot of work with Japanese beetles and has found something with the active ingredient, acelaprin, to be a whole lot less toxic to bees and especially targets the chewing insects, of which the Japanese beetles are a member of. So, and it's relatively safe for humans. So that's something that we could, look to here, going into the future.
Is that acelaprin? Is that?
Yeah.
Acelaprin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Tom, there you go. Good luck. I appreciate your, do you ever cover your roses, at all, David? With a floating row cover or anything?
Yeah, I have so many that it would be really hard. So one thing that I love, just for a nice little point, is so the hardier the rose that we have, so the more wood that overwinters, the larger the beautiful June display of roses will be. And we get to enjoy that display before the Japanese beetles come the end of June into July. So So the hardier roses are wonderful because we get that big, glorious display before the Japanese beetles come. And then I learn to try to ignore them a little bit. And then I usually have a pretty good fall bloom again.
Thank you, Tom. Sherrer in Brookfield, let's go to you next. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions. The first is there a good way to protect the roses in winter, in difficult winters? And the second is that is there any way to grow roses from their seeds?
Those are great questions. So for winter, at least for myself, because I'm breeding new roses, and maybe I'll just take a moment, if we have time here, to describe the process. As I make crosses, I use standard pollinations, traditional plant breeding. Every seed is genetically unique. Every one is different. And I'll collect those seeds in the fall. I make my pollinations now because the fruits take all summer to mature. I collect the seeds in the fall. And there's lots of wonderful resources to help us learn about starting roses from seed. But so I take the seeds. I give them a cold, moist treatment. So I put the seeds and moist peat moss in the refrigerator to mimic winter and their hormonal changes occur. And then usually about New Year's Day or so, I take them out of the refrigerator because they've gotten their chilling by then. And then I start them early under lights. And everyone's genetically different. And then I plant them out. See who's hardy, see who's healthy. I don't cover my roses in the plots in order to see that, see what's hardy. And then after there's a really good one, then they're cloned. So that means making genetic copies through cuttings or grafting. So we'll have that predictability knowing that, okay, they'll be just like all the others in terms of flower color and other characteristics. So the roses that we buy in the marketplace are the best of the best of all these seedlings that people have sorted through. Here's a really good one. And then it's cloned to come to us at the garden center. So it's fun to start roses from seed. It's great to get all that diversity. I just grow them under shop lights like you would start tomatoes or petunias in the spring. For winter hardiness, if we're growing roses that are a little bit more tender and we want to insulate them, what I've done for those relatively few that are real precious to me is add some insulation as the caller described, but this is what I like to do. First of all, I plant the rose a little bit deeper, a few inches deeper at the time of planting, so there's some buds underneath the soil. So if we get a really hard winter, knocking it all the way down to the ground, there's at least something for it to sprout back from. And then I'll mound up some soil around the base of the plant before the soil freezes in fall. And then after it's frozen, I'll add some more insulation, be it some leaves or some other organic material. And then in spring, just cut off the dead material, use a hose to wash back the soil. And then, you know, things are good to go. So if you use some soil and it freezes, that makes it more difficult for mice and other things to get in there. And so that's really nice. Otherwise, if we just put a whole bunch of leaves there and no rat bait, you know, they get in there and they'll just chew it all to pieces.
Very good tip. Sherrer, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. David Slezak, our guest today, professor of horticulture at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls, talking with him today about roses. We can probably talk about some other plants as well with him. But zeroing in on roses on the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller again, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, David Slezak, professor of horticulture at the UW River Falls. He has introduced a number of rose cultivars, including many roses and nine bark varieties, specializes in woody plant identification, culture, pathology, and genetics, and does a wonderful job of explaining as we're learning here as we visit with him. Go to Elizabeth and then John after that, but let's go to Elizabeth first in Woodruff. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, my name is Elizabeth Stonefield. I'm calling from my truck in Woodruff, and thank you for taking my call. I have been looking for a type of rose that I had many years ago when I lived in New York, which was a peach color, but it smelled like lemon. I do not think it was a David Austin, because I've asked many David Austin growers, because in the winter I live in Santa Barbara, California. But I was wondering if your guest today would have a clue of what kind of rose that was.
Oh, that's a great question, Elizabeth. There are so many roses. It would be very difficult. So in New York, it's warmer than here, and a lot of the nurseries introduce, you know, many roses every year. Each cultivar often has a lifespan before they come up with more cultivars, because they can only keep them in the catalogs so often. But a lemony fragrance that narrows it down a little bit. There are some roses that tend to have that fragrance a little bit more. My nose isn't always really good at distinguishing all the different kinds, but what years were you in New York? It'll give me a little bit of a clue of what roses may have been popular at that time.
Elizabeth, are you there?
Yes, early, that was mid-90s.
Mid-90s. So some roses, like Singing in the Rain, was popular, and I love that unique fragrance. Singing in the Rain's kind of an apricot, a little bit of, you know, orangish salmon highlights. That's a great question, but I'm not sure, because there's just so many roses within that color range, and so if you're looking for a good apricot colored rose for today for your Wisconsin garden, some really good roses are like Sweet Fragrance. That's a shrub rose out of, or I think they may have classified it more as a Floribunda, but it has a peachish color and a strong fragrance from Bailey Nurseries, which is in the upper Midwest. But I wish I could be more helpful. I'm sorry.
There we go. Elizabeth, you're going to have to continue. Maybe somebody else has some ideas, too, if you know about a peach rose that has a smell sort of like a lemon, or a lemony at least. Give us a call. Or if you have other questions, you could call in too at 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Thanks again, Elizabeth. Let's go to John and Shauno now. John, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Well, hi, guys. Always love your show. Say, this does not have to do with roses, but the raspberries I planted about 13, 14 years ago when I bought my little house here up in Shauno, close to Shauno Lake, they underground, and they're going all over the neighbors' yards. What shall I do is basically my question.
So, raspberries that are getting out of hand.
Oh, that's a problem. And so they're happy. They're doing what raspberries do. So they're spreading. So commercially, what a lot of growers do is, rejuvenate their beds. And so... As it gets into your neighbors, there's, you know, not a whole lot you could do except help them get rid of it. But if it's in lawn, you could use some of the selective herbicides to kind of knock back the raspberries that might translocate back into some of the plants on your side. But it takes a lot of effort to have a bed designated for raspberries and keep knocking back the suckers where you don't want them to go. So at this point, I think it's more just damage control, you know, just trying to help your neighbor and just really knock them back. And then in the future here, just designate the area that you'd really like them to stay within and just show them who's boss.
I don't know how deep those roots go in raspberries, if you can put a sort of a barrier, an underground barrier around the planting?
Yeah, that's a good idea. And if you have a barrier that goes at least a foot, that should hopefully help. But some rhizomes will go under, I'm sure.
it's a lot of work to keep. You must have the perfect soil, John, for them. I wish there was a magic bullet, but there isn't one in this case. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Zeroing in a bit on roses, maybe taking some other plant questions as well with our guest today, David Zlesak from the UW River Falls, where he is a professor of horticulture there and a consulting rosarian. So how long did it take you? Now, your Rosa Above and Beyond, you know, you developed that rose. It's a beautiful rose. How long did it take you to find that rose?
Oh, that's a great question. It took a while. So crossing the two wild species, the Eastern Canada wild rose and the Siberian wild rose, occurred, if I remember right, about 1997. And then a couple years after that, that hybrid got large enough to flower. And the pollination for Above and Beyond happened in 2000. It germinated in 2001, and I knew it was special by about 2003. And it took a long time to come to market. It came to market in 2015, and part of the delay is the downturn in the economy. So a lot of building projects, residential, community projects just wasn't happening, and the landscape industry basically follows the economy. And so nurseries were saying, well, it's a large rose. People wouldn't be able to plant too many of them. So we're not sure if we want to introduce it. Now is not the right time. So eventually the economy loosened up, and they thought, oh, we'll give it a try. So it came on the market in 2015.
And this, when you talk about large, I mean, the mature height of this is 10, 12 feet, isn't it? Or even higher?
Yeah, it could be even higher. So my really good friend and one of my two rose breeding mentors as a kid, Bill Rattler in Milwaukee, he has some plants up the side of his large building. So he built a wonderful trellis, and it's probably at least 15 feet tall there. So you could let it grow as a large freestanding shrub like a big lilac, or you could train it up a structure, a trellis, an arbor, a pillar.
And we're talking about a pretty good range of hardiness zones for that one, too, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, a dear friend in Houston has a plant. It gets really large, and there's other roses down there that reflower more abundantly. So, but at least it survives down there. But it's a good option for us in the north, where we don't have very many choices for cold, hardy climbers.
At least 3 to 5, 3 to 7, maybe on the hardiness zones.
Yeah, yep. And people in Europe are enjoying it too, Northern Europe and in Canada. So it makes me happy when people are enjoying plants that I've bred.
Oh, absolutely. Barb called to say she planted geraniums near her roses last year, and she thinks the geraniums killed off her Japanese beetles.
Okay. hopefully it deterred some of them. So those Japanese beetles are sure hungry, and they travel so readily. So with large roses and short geraniums, I suspect that a Japanese beetle landing on top of a tall rose would munch for a while before the scent of a geranium might take them away. But it's important. It's important to make these observations, and hopefully there's something to it, and that gives researchers something to follow up on. At University of Minnesota, I'm going to help with a little project that'll start with Japanese beetles, and we're going to look at different rose varieties and compare and contrast Japanese beetle preference. and see what makes them different biochemically.
Yeah, they do seem to love roses, and grapes are another one that the Japanese beetles really like.
Yeah, there's some grapes that seem to have some resistance. So as part of the study, they're going to compare the grapes that are very susceptible to these resistant ones to see the biochemical differences. And we have some roses that we think are a little bit less attractive, and we'll do the same there too. So hopefully over time we'll begin to have more answers.
Krista in Madison emailed us to say that she was told that James Galloway climbing roses do well in partial shade. And wondering if you agree with that. And do you know of any climbers that do well in partial shade?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm not familiar with that variety. Mm-hmm. But there definitely are some roses that are more shade tolerant than others. So one rose that I especially love that just blooms in the spring but has some nice ornamental fruit later that gets kind of large that can be used as a climber is a species rose called Rosa eglantaria, the eglantine rose. And what's so special about that rose is that the leaves smell like apples. So they have glandular trichomes, little hairs on the leaves that when they're bruised or there's high humidity, it just wafts this fragrance through the air. It's a European species, and it's native to forest edges or within forests. So these plants grow up into trees a little bit. In Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night Dream, supposedly there's an area within that piece that talks about the eglantine roses and the fragrance. So Rosa eglantaria is pretty shade tolerant, and I love it for that. But in general, the more sun, the better for our roses, because they sure bloom a lot more prolifically.
Alice and her leader dog, Willow, emailed to say that most blind and visually impaired gardeners would prefer to avoid wearing heavy gloves for handling roses. Can you recommend a variety of rose that does not have the typical thorns?
That's a fantastic question. There's a whole series called the Smooth Touch Roses, bred by the late Harvey Davidson, and they're all thornless. There's hybrid teas and floribundas, a range of colors. I'm surprised that thornless roses haven't caught on in the marketplace and are more popular. For Wisconsin, here's a variety that is not only thornless, but has some extra hardiness that you don't have to do a lot of insulation and overwinters pretty well. Basie's Blueberry.
Huh.
Robert Basie. He was a professor of mathematics at Texas A&M, and he loved rose breeding. And upon his death, he endowed a position. Dr. David Byrne is in the endowed position for rose breeding and genetics. And Dr. Basie bred this one, Basie's Blueberry. And it's as thornless as can be. My plant's in full bloom right now at home. So I think that combines hardiness and thornlessness the best for us. But then there's also these other roses that you may need to insulate for winter a little bit, the Smooth Touch series.
Mm. Let's take another call. Vicki in Eau Claire, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have a John Cabot climbing rose.
Yep.
It's thriving and it looks beautiful, but I have trouble getting it to climb. Seems like when I prune it, it sends up three shoots. And it wants to be a shrub rose. I'm having trouble getting it on my trellis.
That's a great question, and that brings up the point of, you know, for climbing roses, what does that really mean? So they're not quite like clematis or other plants that actually naturally wrap around support structures quite readily. So these climbing roses are large growing plants that we can coax or tie to support structures. So Sometimes it takes a while. We have to help them get through those gangly teenage years a little bit in terms of real vigorous shoots from the base that we could coax and train a little bit as they're elongating the direction that we want until they eventually get there. So it is hard at first, isn't it, to get some of these canes to go where we want. But for really hardy roses, like John Cabot, William Baffin, Above and Beyond, eventually, hopefully, we have enough structure, enough canes that are enduring over time that we get to the skeleton of our climbing rose in place. And then side branches off of that could eventually, you know, fill in the gaps in our trellis. And so I'd be patient and take those vigorous shoots that are starting, and while they're still a little bit flexible, kind of coax them with gentle, string and ropes and things until you eventually get them the direction that you need them.
Takes a little while, though, I guess, Vicki. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to David in Renshaw, Minnesota. David, hello.
Hello. Say, we have some invasive wild roses that we'd like to know how to get rid of. They're not very attractive. They really have a lot of really fine thorns and few blossoms, so they're really not doing us much good.
Are they low growing? Are they tall? Could they be Rosa multiflora, do you think, or is it just one of our natives?
Or knee height?
They get up.
Yeah.
Knee height.
About knee height, right.
Okay.
They're thick, dense.
They're thick and dense. So there's a couple options. One that comes to my mind is it may be Rosa arkansana, because that one does stay relatively short and it sends out these rhizomes that really fill in an area, especially in the full sun. So for these unwanted spreading wild roses, a lot of digging or using some herbicide to really knock them back are the options that are there.
If you've got a patch, could you mow them off and cover them?
Sure. Yep. We could, knock them back and cover them just to smother out all the vegetation. Yep, if it's not too big. And so that's definitely an option. So in a real large area and the rhizomes have really spread, it might be a little bit difficult, but.
Yeah, there you go, David. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Jim in Bloomer, it's your turn. Hi, Jim.
Thank you. I just have a comment about the Japanese beetles and geraniums. Somebody said that geraniums probably kill the Japanese beetles. Well, my wife just prides herself in having the greatest geranium plants around. Everybody comments on them, but last year the Japanese beetles just kind of took out the geranium plants.
So they ate your geraniums.
Oh, they ate them. They loved them. And we got raspberries around too, and they were eating them too, but they went right on the geraniums. And I put an insecticide on the geraniums, and I killed so many that the dirt in the pot started to stink from the dead Japanese beetles.
Wow.
Oh, man. Oh. And, Jim, is this your first year with a heavy was last year your first year with a heavy amount of Japanese beetles?
Oh, we've had them a lot, and they never bothered the geraniums too much because I suppose there's other things to eat. I don't know, but. Yes, this was last year was really, really bad with them for some reason. But actually, didn't have many in other plants around, but they were attracted to geraniums.
Well, I tell you, your only hope, I was talking to Phil Pelletieri, our entomologist, and Phil says they do tend to run in a bit of a cycle. In Madison, we had tons of them for a while and in some parts of the city. And now they're in a more manageable number. So let's hope you've reached your peak, Jim, and maybe they'll start on the downside. But We know now that they will eat geraniums. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. David Slezak, our guest today, professor of horticulture at the University of Wisconsin River Falls. Great to have him with us. He has a number of cultivars that he's introduced, including many roses and nine bark varieties. Haven't talked about those nine barks much yet. We'll get to that. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network.
Now's your inning. Stand the world on its ear. Set it spinning. That will be just the beginning. Cutting up like the lights. You've got nothing to hit but the heights. You'll be swell.
You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network, taking a look at roses. We're zeroing in a bit on roses. We can take some other plant questions as well with our guest, David Slezak, professor of horticulture at the UW River Falls. So wonderful having him with us today. Let's take another call. Judy in Madison, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking the call. I have recently moved just outside of Madison to Wanakee, and was gifted a fairy rose, which I've had in the past. The ticket said pink, but the flowers initially started out as being white. Now they're starting to turn pink again. Is there any way that I can keep them white, and what do I feed them?
Oh, those are great questions. So the fairy is a wonderful rose with lots of little tiny flowers and these expansive clusters. For the rest of the listeners, it came out in the 1930s, and the fairy is wider than it is tall. It's a wonderful, relatively low-growing ground cover type rose. It's actually apparent in the background of many of our more recent ground cover roses. It came out in the 1930s. So sometimes, depending on the temperature and other sort of factors, colors might be a little bit more faded. So the pigment that gives roses and other plants kind of the pinks and reds and purple tones have some sugars that are linked to those molecules. So if the plant is a little short on sugars, or if the light, the temperature is a little bit different, sometimes the pigments don't fully develop. So I don't think it's possible to keep it white. So the thing to do then would be to purchase a rose like maybe White Drift or some of these other kind of similar growing roses in white. And I forgot, what was your second question?
Just what to feed it, and if there's something that you can feed it that will keep the Japanese beetles or something away?
That's a great question. So for these roses, they fall under the category of polyantha roses that the fairy's a member of. So these little flowered roses tend to be a little less attractive to the Japanese beetles, fortunately. So to keep the Japanese beetles away, there's not a whole lot that we can do. Those beetle traps tend to bring in more than they catch. So unless you put a beetle trap at your neighbor's to kind of lure the Japanese beetles away from your property, there isn't a whole lot that we could do. But for the fairy, fortunately, it's less susceptible to Japanese beetles than some of the larger flowered roses.
There you go, Judy. Thank you very much for calling.
I have a story, Larry, about Japanese beetles.
Go ahead, David.
So they eat so many different species, and they're just so prolific. So I also breed ageratum, and ageratum is this plant that's typically used as an annual. It comes in blue and white and pink. And so I've crossed other ageratum species together with our cultivated forms and have some vigorous, unique forms. But so as I plant out thousands of ageratum, it's just fun to see that when a stray Japanese beetle chews on it, it becomes paralyzed. There's an insecticidal property inside of ageratum. The bunnies don't eat it either. So that's just kind of fun to see a paralyzed Japanese beetle.
So maybe you can plant a little of that around your fairy roses or around your other roses to maybe get rid of a few of those Japanese beetles. It's worth a thought. Thanks, Judy. Pete in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Pete.
Hi. My wife's wedding bouquet was hocus pocus roses, and I'd like to grow them. I live in Milwaukee. Where can I get them?
Hocus pocus rose. I don't know that rose.
So a lot of the cut roses that we get at the florist shop, beginning about the 1960s and 70s, there was a divergence in terms of breeding for different markets. Before that point, the same hybrid teas especially were sold for garden use, grown as cut flowers. As competition increased, eventually as production of cut roses began to go offshore to places such as Ecuador and Colombia, Kenya, unique varieties were bred specifically for that use and that climate. So it would be really difficult to be able to purchase some of these cut flower varieties for garden use, and a lot of times they're not all that great for garden use. Let's see here. I'm trying to look up the picture online. It's a wonderful striped rose, right? So it's beautiful, rich, kind of deep red with kind of yellow stripes. Is that right?
Gorgeous.
So there are some miniature roses like Memphis King that you could get through some of the mail order specialty nurseries that come in this color. So you can get at least a similar kind of rose like Memphis King that you could grow in your garden. But I think it would be really difficult to be able to get into the supply chain and purchase a single plant or two from the cut rose industry.
Yeah. There's one called Anna's Promise. Would that work?
Anna's Promise, part of... Oh, what was the name of that? Oh, the Downton Abbey collection. Yeah. So, you know, that's a beautiful rose from Weeks. It doesn't quite have the same the color combination that Hocus Pocus has, but it's a gorgeous rose, and if I remember right, it's nicely fragrant, too.
Yeah, very fragrant rose. That's what attracted me to that one. So, Pete, there you have it. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Kel in Sugar Camp up next. Hi, Kel.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I was interested in some roses I had seen a few years back, and I was wondering if they're still being grown, if you recognize them. Two of the apricots were Whiskey Mac and Brandy. They were like light bulbs in the garden. I mean, they were amazing. And another one was this fabulous large white rose, Frau Karl Juski. And the petals were like wax. It was a strong, big white rose. And then the fourth one was a green rose. A friend of mine had a real green rose shrub, and it was really old. And I was wondering if you see any of these around anymore.
Yeah, you're taking me back to my youth. So, yeah, they were in the catalogs when I was a kid. And Brandy, Whiskey Mac, all those. And for the green rose, there's a number of them. There's mint julep, I remember, that had a bit of a green color. There's the little flowered rose called the green rose. That's a hybrid China rose. So sometimes it's hard to find some of these classic varieties, and some of the mail order catalogs that ship roses out of California and other places, we can get our hands on them. One of the wonderful resources that's available, especially to nursery people, but we as individual gardeners can participate too. At University of California, Davis, they have what's called Foundation Plant Services, FPS. And they take new roses as they come into the market. They test them for viruses. And if they test clean, they go into this clean block area. And then nursery people can order propagation material off of those roses. and Whiskey Mac, Brandy, some of these old favorites are still in their collection. And I remember Frau Karl Druschke, that beautiful white old hybrid perpetual. I'm not sure if they have that one. But if we can't find some of our old favorites, what we can do is go on to the Foundation Plant Service website and see if it's in their collection and order some cuttings and do our best to try to root our own cuttings.
Oh, there you go, Kel. Worth a try to and maybe the only option you've got, really, when you get right down to it. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have Monica emailed to ask if you could tell her if all varieties, this goes to lilacs now, can be pruned back to about a third of their height. She has three different lilacs that need pruning badly. She's seen overgrown lilacs in the city parks, and they prune them back to less than a third of their height. These keep coming back and blooming every year. There's, I think, a better way to do it than just prune it all down a third of its height.
Yeah. So with these large shrubs, especially lilacs that have durable canes that persist for many, many years, what I love to do is rejuvenation pruning. And so what that means is that like every couple years, I'd love to go in, and if there's a cane that is getting pretty large at the tip, the branches are getting kind of thin and sparse, and the blooms aren't as large and prolific as they used to be, I'll take that cane all the way down to the ground. So I'm rejuvenating the plant with nice, strong canes coming up from the base. And I might take out, you know, just a couple canes every year or two, or depending on how large the plant is or what's going on. By cutting back a third, we eventually kind of get a congestion in the middle if we never totally remove some of those interior canes. So we could head back the branches so that we could have a more symmetrical plant, a tidy plant, and then get in there and take out some of the canes all the way down to the ground to rejuvenate it with strong, vigorous canes that support stronger flowering. So for lilacs, the general recommendation is to wait until after they bloom so we could at least enjoy their blooms, and then get in there and strategically make our cuts.
Yeah, that's the best recommendation, I think, for pruning back lilacs for sure. Martin in New Berlin wondered if you can – he wants to replace his burning bushes and get rid of them. Can you recommend shrubs with great fall color?
Oh, that's a great question. So there are a number of shrubs that have good fall color. Sometimes if we have a nice long fall, some of the rugosa roses become a nice sort of golden with purple highlights. There are some unique spireas, like the Fritsch spirea, Miabii spirea, that has a wonderful fall color to its foliage as well. So sometimes, like Miss Kim Lilac, in the fall, we get beautiful golden and purple highlights on that relatively compact lilac that gets about the same size as a burning bush.
Yeah, I like that one a lot. That's a pretty lilac for sure. And it's small.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's smaller. So those are some ideas for you, Martin. I appreciate that email. How many plants do you have on your property?
Oh, Larry, that's a great question. I lost count. This morning, I got the tractor out and tilled up a new bed for the new seedlings. I probably have 3,000 or 4,000 in 3-inch pots ready to plant in the ground. And we had a tough winter, so I lost a lot of roses in my beds, which is just fine because I know they're not hardy enough, but I don't know how many thousands I have.
Oh, my goodness me. Fun talking today with David Slezak. David is a professor of horticulture at the University of Wisconsin, River Falls. He's a certified professional horticulturist, consulting rosarian, has introduced a number of cultivars, including many roses and nine bark varieties. Specializes in woody plant identification, culture, pathology, and genetics. Our guest for Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller.
what's your inning? Stand the world on its ear. Set it spinning. That will be just the beginning. Cutting up like the lights. You've got nothing to hit but the heights. You'll be swell. You'll be great. I can tell. Just you wait. That lucky star I talk about is you. Honey, everything's coming up roses for me and for you. You can do it. All you need is a hand. Mama is gonna see to it. Cut up like the lights. We've got nothing to hit but you'll be swell. You'll be great. Gotta have the whole world on a plate. Starting here, starting now. Honey, everything's coming.
You are listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Our guest today, David Slezak, is a professor of horticulture at UW River Falls, talking with him about roses and other woody plants. Well, David, besides roses, you also work with native ninebark plants. For those who aren't familiar with it, what are its characteristics?
Yes, that's a great question. They're a close relative to spirea. So they look like just large spirea plants. They're in bloom right now. Some of them are getting towards the end of their bloom, so they have these clusters of little white flowers like some of the earlier flowering spireas. They live especially along roadsides, kind of near streams and rivers. The wild forms are large. They have green leaves. They're kind of shaped like maple leaves a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and they get kind of large. They get maybe 6 to 8 feet tall in the wild, and they're called nine bark because as they get older, their bark begins to peel. So I don't know if there really is nine layers, but but there's a bunch of layers.
And is that why you like working with that plant, the bark layers, or what is it about the plant?
Yeah, I enjoy the bark. The bark's beautiful, especially in winter. So back in 2001, I was looking at a wonderful landscape, and this new variety of nine bark that came on the market was in this garden called Diablo, and that was the first purple leafed variety, and it was started from seed actually by a German nursery. Sometimes we don't always appreciate what we have, and so other people in the world enjoy our wonderful native plants, and then they begin working with them. And out of all these seedlings, there was this purple mutation, and Diablo is a large growing nine bark, 6, 8, 10 feet tall. And I was looking at Diablo and then a short, compact, well-branched, little green-leafed one that was on the market called Nanus. And I thought, well, what if we could combine the purple foliage of Diablo with the compact, tidy, manageable size of Nanus? So that's what started the breeding process.
Ah, and how's it going?
It's going well. So I made the cross back in 2001, and half of the offspring were purple. They were all kind of intermediate in size. In 2004, another nine bark from that same cross, very similar to my hybrids, came on the market called Summer Wine, which is a great nine bark. And then instead of giving up, I thought, well, Summer Wine and my hybrids still aren't as compact as the little green one called Nanus. So I took my best, most mildew-resistant hybrid and back-crossed it to that compact little green one called Nanus and got a new population, lots of variation in size and features. And out of that came my hybrid Little Devil, which came on the market in 2011.
Little Devil.
Yeah, the marketers wanted to parallel the name of its grandfather, so Diablo. So I suggest a Little Angel because it's so well-behaved, but Little Devil it is.
Well, Christine in Wauwatosa, let's give you a chance now. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Good morning. I have two questions.
Okay.
My first question has to do with the rose bush, a climbing rose that we had in our backyard that would climb over a big fence every summer.
Yep.
And it didn't make it over the winter. Just, there's nothing, nothing green at all. And I'm just thinking it probably was just because it was such a hard winter. But,
I'm sorry.
And then I have another question. I also have a grapevine that we used to love every summer. I'd sort of gauge how long the summer was because the grapes would hang, they'd get longer, and the vines would get longer and longer as the summer went on. And that also seems to have nothing living on it. I'm just wondering if you could give me any advice.
Oh.
Yeah.
Doesn't sound good.
No, it was an awkward winter, wasn't it? And so my boxwoods are all terribly burned. So some plants suffered more than others. And so sometimes these test winters come about. So when the temperatures are experienced, you know, how much sunlight versus cloudiness there is throughout the winter, moisture, all those things interact. So you're looking closely at your precious plants and I would just, you know, be patient and just hope that a little sign of life may come from the base and you could rebuild your plants. But it's already towards the end of June, so it may not happen.
Yeah, they're probably goners, unfortunately. And, Christine, you probably had a really cold winter. And maybe go back to David, you could comment again if she puts those in again, how she should sort of handle them, you know, getting into winter and so forth. You talked about covering a little bit with soil at the base and so forth.
Yeah, so first and foremost, see what the latest varieties are, and hopefully you could choose, you know, a grape variety, maybe from University of Minnesota Breeding Program, you know, other grapes that are very, especially hardy and tried and true. So then that'll help set us up for success, as well as another climbing rose that may be a little bit more reliably hardy. So that's the first step. And then afterwards, other things that help are to not over-fertilize, especially towards fall, because we don't want to interfere with the natural hardening off and acclimation process. So that helps our plants get ready for winter and be a little bit more hardy as well. And then we could add insulation as needed too. So for instance, some of the tender grapes, friends of mine, they put them on a trellis, and then they take them off the trellis, lay them down against the ground, and put straw there and a little rat bait, and then put them back up. For the climbing roses, if you really want to grow a tender climbing rose, you could do something similar there too. But fortunately, we have some hardy climbing roses and also some hardier grapes.
Yeah, there you go, Christine. Thank you so much. Christina in Glenwood, your turn. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. I have a large shrub rose with pink flowers. Can you tell me if the flowers are edible? If so, how to harvest them? And are all roses edible?
Those are great questions. Yes, all roses are edible. So just keep in mind, you know, if you've had any pesticide applications, you know, then we wouldn't want to eat them. But so the petals are edible. They're used in wonderful jellies. Right here in my office, a dear friend in the chemistry department that's doing some chemistry projects at roses with me, she gave me this jar of jelly that she made out of petals of John Davis rose. So we could also use the rose hips, so the fruit. So there's wonderful European dessert soups and jams and jellies and things made out of rose hips. So roses are edible. They're used in medicine. So as we look, you know, back at herbal medicine, the apothecary's rose. Rose water is still used today for acne and other applications. So there's some strong antioxidant, antimicrobial components to roses, and they're delicious and healthy for us.
Yeah, there you go, Christine. Thank you so much. Chris in Stratford, your turn. Hi, Chris.
Question about lily beetles?
Lily beetles.
I had they're these little red beetles that got on my lilies, and at my old house, they just destroyed them. And I was wondering if there's a way to prevent them at my new house, because I want to have lily gardens again.
Yeah, that's a great question. So these red lily beetles, I'm trying to look up a little bit more about them. I just have a few lilies. I think I've seen them in lily collections, but I don't know of anything offhand that, you know, that's, you know, really good against them. You know, just probably some standard pesticides, but I'm sorry I don't have a good answer.
Can't help you out with that one, Chris. I'm sorry. So we will move on to an email from Patricia. She was wondering if you could talk about ground cover roses, growing roses that don't need to get so big in containers, and getting them to survive the winter. There you go. So a couple of things there.
Great. So... Oh, ground cover roses are becoming very, very popular. The Drift series has a number of different colors in that series, and they're all ground cover roses, about 7 or 8. And there's other brands out there with lots of different cultivars. So these ground cover roses are wider than they are tall, and they tend to have lots of relatively small flowers, so they just give us a carpet of color. There's the flower carpet series, many others out there as well. So one of the challenges when we're growing roses or other typically hardy plants in pots is to overwinter them well. So plant roots are not as hardy as the stems. So fortunately, the soil is insulated. Even though it freezes, it doesn't get a whole lot below freezing, even though the air temperature might get very cold. So the roots don't have to endure as cold the temperatures. But when we have a pot and we elevate that soil up into the air on our patio or our deck, that soil becomes the same temperature as the air. So even a normally hardy plant, a crown hardy rose, elevated like that, could die over winter. So what we can do is we could either dig out the rose bush, bury it in our standard maybe vegetable garden when we're done with the season with our annual vegetables, and then lift it up and plant it back in the spring. I have a lot of pots of roses. So what I do is I take all the pots, I put them close together, and then what I do is put a tarp over them and then construction blankets. That's the easiest thing that I found. So those blankets with high R value that's used for concrete work, I put those over all my pots as it gets really cold before it gets into the mid-20s, usually in November. And then I put another tarp over everything just to hold it down, a light-colored tarp to reflect the sunlight. And then come spring, I just take all that off and I'm good to go. So you could either insulate the whole rose with the whole pot. You could dig out the rose, you know, put it somewhere in your garden, put it back in your pot come spring.
Let's go to Travis next in Madison. Travis, hello.
Hi there.
What can we do for you?
My question is on hazelnut shrubs or trees, I guess you could call them. I just bought a house, and they have some that are planted pretty close to the side of the house. I'm just curious if the roots are going to be an issue and if I should think about getting rid of them.
Hey, did you say hazelnuts?
Yeah, they're hazelnuts.
Trees.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they're really close to the house.
Hmm. Yeah, they're a couple feet off the house, maybe.
Oh.
So hazelnuts get kind of large, don't they? So,
yeah.
So they're these large shrubs, maybe 8, 10 feet tall, and then they will spread a little bit over time with some shoots that sprout up. So for another reason, just for, you know, maybe security, so you could, you know, make sure that, you know, people aren't, you know, hiding behind there or whatever, it's nice to frame the positive features of our home, like the windows and things, but then have, you know, access and be able to see in areas where we want to see. So hazelnuts do get kind of large. You know, if you have a well-constructed house, you know, I don't think, you know, hazelnuts is going to, like, break your foundation or your basement or anything. You know, so some of the more vigorous kind of maples and such might get into some of your sewer system pipes and plug those up. But I think I'd cut them back or remove them for these other reasons.
Yeah, I think they're – I agree. I think they're too close. I think they're too close, Travis. Maybe you could dig them out if you want to move them. Could probably give that a try, although it's pretty tough to get the well, it depends. If they're fairly small, you could probably dig them out and move them elsewhere. Otherwise, you could probably just get rid of them. There you go. Cameron in Madison has a question about cut flowers. You know, when you buy flowers for, you know, having in a vase, they always come with little packets. And he wonders if there's any trade secrets to making them last longer. He once worked with a lady who swore by adding a little Dr. Pepper soda to the water.
That's a great point. So these floral preservatives accomplish a few different things. So one of the things is it lowers the pH, so the water is more acidic. And it has some antimicrobial components to help prevent bacteria from growing. And the bacteria could plug up the stems, restrict the flow of water, and lead to wilting. So low pH, antimicrobial. And then the last thing is energy source. So they usually use dextrose. Dextrose is a type of sugar. So these cut flowers, then, as the flowers continue to open and petals expand a little bit, it gives them that little bit of energy. So traditionally in the past, people would put an aspirin in water, okay, salicylic acid, that acidifies things. People might put a little drop or teaspoon of bleach per quart or per gallon, okay, there's an antimicrobial. Soda is acidic, has some sugar in it, maybe there's a little bit of an antimicrobial. So ultimately, what you most benefit from is having each of those three different purposes represented. Something that acidifies, gives you a little bit of energy source, and an antimicrobial component.
There you go. Lori in Gladstone, Michigan emailed, she has a 3-year-old nectarine tree that was almost completely girdled by rabbits with less than an inch wide strip of bark still continuous to the girdled area. She was going to replace it, but then she noticed it sprouted healthy-looking leaves on over half the branches, though most branch tips are dead. Trees also producing new branches. Should she give it a chance, or is it just too damaged to recover and produce fruit in the future? Only an inch-wide strip of bark, still continuous. That's not good.
That's not good. So it depends how much this tree means to her. So what a person can do if there's a tree that you really, really love, something like that happens to early in the spring, and you could look online, look at some how-to videos, is to do something called bridge grafting. You could take some stems from up in the canopy, and you could graft those little stems into that damaged or missing girdled part. So attach the stem, kind of slice and dice, and stick the stem below where the girdling occurred and then above, and hopefully those stems will heal in there and become that bridge for water and nutrient flow. You have to do that early in the spring before things start growing too much. So that's one thing that a person can do if there's a tree that's really important to them. It sounds like this tree, you know, has some life coming back. You know, if she cuts back, you know, all the dead tips and wants to give it a chance, you know, it may eventually recover, put some hardware cloth around it, you know, for this next winter, just to keep those little critters away.
Yeah, get some hardware cloth down there for sure. Deborah and Brown Deer, what's on your mind?
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, I'm trying to identify a rose. I believe it's a Rambler, and it's about 55 years old. It's like petite blooms and like about a magenta color, and it, I thought it was dead at one point, but now it isn't. And but it's just lovely, and it has a slight fragrance. Do you have any idea? And what about garlic? Planting garlic with roses, does that help?
Good questions. So Rambler roses, these roses that actually have a little bit more of a flexible stem, they're just wonderful, and there aren't too many that are totally keen hardy for us. But there's a number of really popular older Ramblers that came out about 1900 into about the 1920s. And one really, really popular one is called American Pillar, that is kind of magenta. There's Crimson Rambler, which has a lot of petals. So Crimson Rambler, if I remember right, you know, it's a double-flowered one, and then the American Pillar has five petals. So looking back into, some of the older Ramblers, there's some books out there that maybe you could get through your local library and just page through and see if something matches. But Crimson Rambler, American Pillar were some of the more popular ones. For garlic, garlic doesn't, hurt. I don't think there's, strong scientific evidence, that it really helps our roses, significantly.
I haven't read anything that, it's not going to hurt. Let's put it that way, but it may not help a lot, but it's not going to hurt. David, thanks, Deborah. I appreciate it. David, we are out of time. I want to thank you so much. I hope we have a chance to do this again. I appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you so much, Larry. It's been my pleasure being with you and the great audience. Thank you.
David Slezak is a professor of horticulture at the University of Wisconsin River Falls, certified professional horticulturist, consulting rosarian. He's produced a number of cultivars, including many roses and nine bark varieties. Great to have him with us to talk mostly about roses. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network.
Great, I can tell, just wait, that lucky star I told